You're listening to the Boogeyman's Closet podcast. Explicit language and spoilers ahead. You've been warned. And we are back for yet another episode of the Boogeyman's Closet. As always, I am Mike Alvarez.
Maurice Skillifer.
Susie Hunt.
And we have a special guest with us today.
Eric Butel.
Thank you for joining us, good sir. I hear this is one of your favorite movies, so we'll get into this. This is episode 55. It's I Know What You Did Last Summer. It's an hour and 41 minutes, came out in 1997, and directed by Jim Gillespie, who I only recognize from one film, which is that 2005 movie Venom. But apparently he also did a Joyride, but not the Joyride that you're thinking of. It's Joyride from 1995, which is another thriller of a similar ilk to the Candy Cane Joyride. So, yeah, let's go around the table and see what everyone thought. Eric, since you're our guest, we'll start with you.
Oh boy. Okay. I'm a huge fan of this movie. It was, I get, like, it's not, you know, the scariest movie ever made. And I feel like I hear a lot of people in, like, horror fans especially, like, kind of shrug it off, or it's, you know, kind of tossed aside or just flat out hate it. But I really like it because it was kind of a gateway for me, as I'm sure it was a lot of people. And it came out after Scream. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of the first movie in that late 90s boom that played it straight, which is ironic, you know, given who it was written by.
Right.
But it plays it straight, and it's shot incredibly well, and it takes a long time for the setup, I think, or I feel like at least, without it ever seeming boring. And I think that really pushes it as being like this sort of campfire ghost story that it literally references. And mm-hmm. Also, I think it resonates a little bit more personally, like, and with a lot of people, I think, because it is dealing with like an immeasurable like amount of guilt, mm-hmm. and that how that kind of weighs down on people, and especially if you're younger and you have some crap happen, like, you know, a friend dies or I don't know, you have some injury or something you're going to carry with you the rest of your life. And I think that kind of makes it a cut above the rest. And, you know, and I think the ending actually is especially scary, even though it's just played for like a jump scare considering everything, but we can talk about that later. So I probably went on too long, but
no, not at all. No, I'm actually glad to have you at the table, because you're right. This is one of the, one of those movies you hear a lot of people complain about or mock. And, I'm kind of with you to a degree. Like, it's not one of my favorites, but I love this genre of slasher. I often cite Scream as being like responsible for bringing horror back into the mainstream. And I friggin' adore the entire Scream franchise. Like, even the MTV series, I love everything about the Scream series. But I have a soft spot for these particular type of slasher films. And there was that boom in the late 90s and early 2000s. You know, like this, Scream, Urban Legend, Cry Wolf. There was tons of them coming out around that time. And most of them, if not all of them, were a lot of fun. You know, maybe not the best of movies, but they were a lot of fun. But Susie, what did you think about this?
This movie, I agree. It's not necessarily the best movie. I group I Know What You Did Last Summer into like the nostalgia factor. And Mike, you and I are pretty much the same age. Mm-hmm. So like I group this with movies that make me remember fun stuff about being a teenager. So with movies like The Craft, The Crow, Urban Legend, The Faculty, well, of Scream, of course. But, and it has an all-star cast.
Well, oh, yeah.
Let me get to that in a second. But I really like how it builds up. And I mean, when I was younger, I probably watched this movie a ton of times, and the second one as well. And it still holds up for me. And maybe it's the nostalgia factor. And I know we've talked about this before in another episode, where if I saw this movie now for the first time, would I enjoy it as much? I don't know, because I associate it with being, you know, 18 years old, you know, going off to college, stuff like that. But right. We have an all-star cast. We have one, I don't want to say him last, because he's an integral part of the movie. We have the Gorton's fisherman, and he plays many different characters. And poor old man gets, like, knocked down, broken hip. He still gets up, and he's playing the different characters. So good on you, Gorton's fisherman. We have Sebastian from Cruel Intentions, Fred from Scooby-Doo. We have Julia, who is the ghost whisperer. And probably the biggest star in this movie, in my book, is Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Truth.
Yes.
And then Anne Heche, who in this movie, she really reminds me of the main character in High Tension. Her book.
Yes, yeah.
And that really kind of creeped me out, like, when, well, we'll get into it, but I thought her look, that feel of her, that setting, really reminded me of High Tension.
Yeah.
Minus the headless blowjob, or the severed head blowjob.
And the murder masturbation?
Right.
Oh, we got to get that on this show. Maurice, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, it's actually one of the movies I actually saw in the theater, surprisingly. I didn't wait for it to come on DVD. I actually saw it in the theater.
Well, Maurice, back then they had the thing called VHS.
Yes.
No, I was rich. I had a DVD player.
Oh, bougie well, over here.
Wouldn't it have been a Laserdisc back then?
Not really. But the best part about the movie, Johnny Galecki's a badass.
Oh, that's right. I forgot David from Roseanne is in this movie. Yep. Oh.
He does, I mean, other than his last scene, but he's a pretty big badass in this movie. And you're used to him seeing him as the nerd and, you know, the guy that's always getting pushed around.
Yep.
Yeah. And you think of him as like Big Bang Theory, or he was like my high school crush, Roseanne, David on Roseanne.
Yeah. He's always David to me.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm half joking, but no, I thought it was cool that he had a kind of different role. And like Susie said, the A-list casting was great.
Mm-hmm.
I watched it today. I watched it earlier today. And I totally forgot that Anne Heche was in it.
Yep.
Like, you think of the big four. And, I mean, she's a top name in Hollywood. Yeah.
And especially, and like, especially at that time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, and so it's kind of hard to believe that she was in it and not as a main player. But I liked the movie. I didn't really care for the sequels. But, you know, all this talk about Scream. This was technically written before Scream.
Yep.
And I'm sure we all read this, but he couldn't get anyone to buy this script. So yeah, he wrote Scream. That got big. So, you know.
I actually, sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead.
No, you're good.
I recently listened to an interview with him, and I always was under the impression the same thing. He said that, because somebody said that in the interview, and he said, well, actually, he wrote that movie, it was Teaching Mrs. Tingle, but it was called Killing Mrs. Tingle.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he sold that,
That was what, Katie Holmes, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And then,
go on.
Then that didn't go anywhere. And he said he wrote Scream, and that started this huge bidding war. And I guess one of the companies that was in that, like, bidding war that basically created his career was Mandalay Entertainment. And so they lost, but there was a producer there, Eric Feig, and he they had the rights to the book. So they basically still wanted him because he was like the hot property. So they approached him after Scream had sold and they basically offered him money and said, you can do whatever you want with this book. Cause he was like, can I make it R-rated? Cause it's kind of, you know, not, I'm sure we'll get into the book, but it's not a very violent book. And they said, yeah, you can do whatever you want, basically. Cause he was such like a sought after name at that time. And so, he wrote it just before Scream was actually like in production, but he did write it like post Scream.
Oh no shit. I see, I didn't know that.
It was on it was on some show I was listening to. I'll send you the name. I apologize. And I'm really sorry for interrupting.
Oh no. Trust me, we interrupt each other all the time. We try not to, but at the same time, with the Skype delay, it's sometimes impossible not to. So don't even worry about it. No big deal at all.
It's a good interview if you're into that sort of like behind the scenes thing, because it's kind of crazy, because that sort of trend of him being such a name, which always happens in Hollywood if you're a actor or director or something, really did happen to him, because he was suddenly getting offers or being forced into writing this movie or that movie, like The Faculty and Halloween, where it was like one thing after another, where it was just like, oh, you're this name, you're this horror guy, do this and we'll pay you lots of money. So
you know, and the funny thing with this is, up until we were doing this for the podcast, I didn't even know there was a book. Like, I have to admit that I didn't know this was based on a book. I never had looked into it.
Yeah, so
now I'm curious. Now I'm like, I kind of want to read the book just to see what it's like. Because
the book kind of sounds boring.
But still, sometimes it's like it's fun just to see where this stuff came from, you know. But yeah, I had no idea it was based on a book until I was reading on some trivia about this. I'm like, oh no shit.
Has anybody read it?
No.
Oh, okay. No. You don't have to. It's a good book. I like it. If you are going to read it, I will say this. It's breezy. I swear to God, it's like 200 pages long. It's very short.
Oh, wow. Okay.
At least the copy I have is. It's a pretty short book. It was published in 1973. Mm. And then in 2010, the author, who hated this movie, by the way, she re-edited it and updated it, and I think Helen, she has a different job. She's doing like a webcast, quote unquote, when she updated it in 2010. So already it probably needs another update.
Right.
But sorry, I probably derailed this, and especially Maurice. So sorry.
Oh, no worries at all.
I'm mad now. I'm not talking the rest of the podcast.
Oh, always mad.
No.
I'm going to get a note.
I know he's on the band's podcast.
Hey, that could be that would be a cool name for a podcast.
I Know What You Did Last Podcast, yeah.
Ooh.
But, no, overall, I do like the movie. Like I said, I didn't really care for the sequels, but this one was okay.
Was there more than one sequel? Was there no... So there was I Know What You Did Last Summer, I Still Know What You Did Last Summer, and then I Still Know What You Did Last Summer?
It's I'll Always Know What You Did Last Summer.
I'll Always Know, yeah.
Oh, really? Was it still... was it still Jennifer Love Hewitt?
No.
No.
Okay, that's why I didn't
see it. It wasn't even the same guy that played the fisherman, but it was the fisherman. He was a zombie.
Wait, really?
Saw it, to be honest with you. I picked it up a couple of times going, maybe I'll get this, and I just never did.
Well, shit the bed, 2006.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it takes... I'm sure there was... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and then the weirder part is it takes place in a Colorado skiing town.
Yeah.
So
nice.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, there was probably a lot of other better movies in 2006.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure there were. Oh, man. But so we'll get into the cast real quick. As Susie kind of already mentioned, but we have Julie James, played by Jennifer Love Hewitt. We would know her from a few things, but I Still Know What You Did Last Summer, the sequel. Can't Hardly Wait, Party of Five, Ghost Whisperer, bunch of stuff like that. Then Helen Shivers was played by Sarah Michelle Gellar. Obviously, Buffy and Angel. She was also in Scream 2, which there's some parallels to Scream 2 and her with her character in this. Small Soldiers, Cruel Intentions, the Scooby-Doo movies, the first two Grudge movies. Then Barry Cox is played by Ryan Felipe. Cruel Intentions, that, what was it called? Was it 54, the Studio 54 movie?
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, God, that movie scarred me for life. Then there was a really good movie with him and Benicio del Toro in the early 2000s called The Way of the Gun. Anyone see that?
Yes.
No.
I really like that movie.
I like that movie a lot. Yeah,
it's fun. It's definitely worth your while if you haven't seen it. Then we got Ray Bronson, played by Freddie Prinze Jr. She's All That, Wing Commander, the Scooby-Doo movies, a lot of voice work. Like, he's been doing a lot of voice work for years. Like, he's in Star Wars Rebel, tons of Robot Chicken. Even does a voice for The Rise of Skywalker, the latest Star Wars movie.
And don't forget, he was a writer for the WWE for a while.
I yes, actually didn't yes. know that.
Yeah.
I can't remember. I think it was like 2011-ish, maybe. But yeah, he was one of the writers for maybe a year.
So that's what he's been up to.
Yeah, he didn't last long. I think he got out real quick.
And then we have Benjamin Willis, a.k.a. the Gordon's Fisherman, or as I wrote him constantly in my notes, Fish Sticks, played by Muse Watson. Now,
or if you're any sports fans out there, the New York Islanders logo from the 1990s, early 2000s.
See, now that I didn't know.
Oh, that's right.
But, I thought that was one of their better jerseys.
he's in quite a few like weird movies. Like, he's in the sequel from Dusk Till Dawn, Texas Blood Money, which is a terrible movie. He's in The Last Exorcism Part 2. There's this movie called Dead Birds that he's in. Have you guys ever seen that?
No.
No, but it sounds terrible.
It's a ghost movie. It's like these, I want to say it was like in the 1800s. There's like a bank heist and these guys are hiding out in this like plantation house. And there were all these ghosts there. It's fairly low budget and lame, but it's got some solid scares. Like, there's,
were there any dead birds?
There were in the yard. Yes. but There's a ghost jump scare with a ghost hiding under a bed that I wasn't quite expecting, and it scared the shit out of me, so I'll always remember that scene. And then there was apparently a 1990 Handmaid's Tale. I never knew that, but he was in that.
Hmm.
So, yeah, there's a film from the 90s. And then we have Elsa Shivers, played by Bridget Wilson Sampras. The thing I mean...
Sampras's ex-wife.
As it, the only thing I knew her from immediately was Mortal Kombat and Billy Madison.
House on Haunted Hill.
I know. I forgot she was in that. I totally forgot she was in that. I was like, holy shit. I mean, granted, it's been probably 20 years since I've watched that movie.
Oh, you're missing out.
Yeah, you are.
The ending,
that movie's, it's a guilty pleasure of mine. The ending is horrible.
That's what, it left such a bad taste in my mouth that I hate the last 5 minutes of it. That it's like, I just forget to go back to it. And isn't Jeffrey Combs in that? I think he plays the ghost doctor.
Yes, he is.
So yeah, you'd think I'd watch more.
I mean, Dr. you like Benedict. Blood Rage, so can we really go by what you like.
I like Blood Rage too.
Or what you don't like.
I don't know why you're pissing in your pants over it.
You guys are talking about the Thanksgiving Blood Rage, right, with the twins?
Yeah, it's Maurice's favorite movie.
Oh, it's... Or
eventually it will be.
I'm with you both on that. I love that movie.
See, you're outnumbered, Reese.
No!
I'm sorry.
It's so good.
I'm going to find
it. No, it's really not.
It's so wonderfully bad that it's awesome.
Horribly awesome. That's what I like to say.
And then we have Melissa Egan, played by Anne Heche. Obviously, we would know her from the horrible remake of Psycho, which, I'm sorry, every time I see her, all I can think of is her freaking butt staring up in the sky. Every time I see her, I just think, shower butthole. Like, it just, it's stuck in my brain.
Now I'm broken.
Oh.
Ooh, okay. She also played Jeffrey Dahmer's mom in My Friend Dahmer, which we covered earlier. It was one of the first podcasts that I was on.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I missed that one.
Yeah, that was you joined us when we did a month of serial killer movies.
Yes.
And we learned some lessons that month when we watched Henry.
Oh boy, yeah. No corpse diddling and no sister fucking.
Exactly. And then we have Max, played by Johnny Galecki. Obviously, like we said, Roseanne, but also Christmas Vacation, Blossom, Vanilla Sky, Big Bang Theory. And that god-awful Third Ring movie, The Rings. Ugh, it was so bad. That's another one.
Another one you dragged me to see.
Yeah, I was going to say, I dragged you to see that one.
I passed on that. Thank you.
Oh, it's so bad. But, yeah, so most people listening to this, as we always say, probably already knows what the movie is about. But basic plot line is that four friends... have a tragic accident, we'll say, and try to cover it up, and then end up reuniting when that accident comes back to bite them in the ass. So it's pretty straightforward plot line. But we open up with like a pan over the ocean side while a very interesting cover of Summer Breeze is playing by Typo Negative.
Come on. That sets the tone for the whole goddamn movie. You are an elder goth just like myself. Don't pretend that you didn't listen to Typo Negative in high school.
I did. But I have that a hard opening. Time going back and listening to him.
I do too. It's okay.
What were you saying?
I said that opening was perfect. I love the song and the shot is... It's again like why I'll stop with the digressions, but that's like why I think it's a cut above the rest, because like I don't know if I'll ever see like a swooping helicopter shot intro to a teen horror movie ever again. Like I don't know, unless you're like, you know, making It Chapter 5 or I don't know. You have that kind of money, you just don't kind of see that anymore at all. And that song's great too. I'm in for that.
Yeah, you know, you're not wrong about the swooping helicopter shot. Like that's one thing I can say for this movie is the cinematography is awesome. There are a lot of great shots like that. And you know, I mean, it wasn't kind of par for the course back in the late 90s, especially with horror films, to have that type of care and attention paid to the cinematography. There's a lot to like about this film, especially about the look of it. But I mean, like I said, it's definitely not my favorite of the teen slasher genre, but it's not a bad movie by any means. But yeah, so we pan up from the water. We see the road by the cliffs and we see a young man sitting on the cliff's edge, drinking and looking at a little medallion. He looks horribly depressed. And then we see fireworks going off in the distance, and we cut to the town having their 4th of July celebration.
I want to add that I have seen this movie many, 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 many times. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I watched it for the podcast that it clicked for me that it doesn't take place in Maine. It's in South Carolina.
Yeah.
Because of the whole fisherman industry. I'm like, oh, fishing industry, like, South Carolina, why are they going to dress, why is the Gorton's fisherman going to be dressed head to toe in a rubber slicker where he's going to sweat his balls off?
You know, that I do have to say, though, on the 4th of July scene, like, I'm sure, I know by the water it would be a little chillier, but yeah, everyone is dressed up in them damn slickers, and I'm like, that, I feel like that would be really fucking hot.
Yeah, that's just, like, it's the sun beating down on you.
Right, and it's a black rubber slicker. Come on.
Right. You might as well be like a frumpy dominatrix at that point.
It is weird. Like, and then later, too, like 1 year later, you know, it's North Carolina, and they, like, I think they're wearing, like, sweaters.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking it's July 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, or something like that. And it is kind of curious. I'm like, I don't. If anything, you would be wearing almost nothing. It's North Carolina. I don't know. I don't live in North Carolina, but I would assume it has to be a hell of a lot warmer than it is here.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Like, why is Jennifer Love Hewitt wearing, is the sweater okay because it's a crop top? Does that make it cooler? But that one scene, she's wearing a fucking school marm outfit, long skirt with the white Keds. And then, like, the little crop top sweater with the long sleeves. And she's running. Like, how are you not, how is your hair, well, she looks strung out at that point anyway. So maybe she is dripping with sweat and I just didn't notice. But they are not dressed appropriate.
No one in this movie is.
I chalked it up to one of those things, like, when I see people, like, in, even people that I've known, like, out in California, and I see them wearing a jacket, I'm like, oh, it's probably 75 degrees, 76 degrees out where they are, but they're probably, that's like cold for them or something. So I don't know. I always chalk it up to that.
I smell like
South Carolina is always pretty warm. So if it gets in the 60s, you know, around July or 70s, they're probably cold.
Much like in the winter when we have like a string weeks and weeks of like single digit temperatures, and then all of a sudden it's 38 degrees and you see dudes out there in flip-flops and shorts.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
So
I
totally get where you're coming from.
Makes sense. But so we cut from the celebration over to the Croker Queen beauty pageant, and this is where we first meet Helen Shivers, and she's talking about how she's gonna help the world through art. She's gonna go to New York City and become an actress and
porn.
And then we see up in the stands Ray, her friends Ray and Julie, and then her boyfriend Barry. And Ray goes, I had no idea her breasts were so ample. And Barry gets all giddy. He's like, dude, she does exercises to pump them up. It's like, it was so cheesy.
But they're teenage boys, so of course.
Well, yeah, breasts make it dumb.
Yeah, I also want to say that the girl standing next to Helen looked like she was 35.
Well, she probably was. I mean, you know how they cast teens in these movies.
Yeah, but Andrea in 90210, she could pull off the teenage look, and she was like 50.
She was already getting her senior discount at coffee shops.
Exactly. She was a member of AARP when she was on that show.
So Helen wins the pageant and is crowned the Croker Queen. And then we cut to the beach party, and I had completely forgotten about this, but as soon as we cut to the beach party, I was like, hey, Southern culture on the skids. Like, I forgot they existed. But so a little cameo by them. And then Max comes up to Julie. This is where we first meet Max. And he wants to toast with her since she's going to be escaping their little town and going off to college. And she refuses, but he gets kind of creepy about it. So this is a trend we're going to see throughout the movie. A lot of times the various guys will get kind of creepy, and a few of the women, but most of the guys get kind of creepy, and you have to question, like, oh, are they the killer? Like, there's a lot of red herrings. But he gets all creepy about it. Barry cuts in, takes the shot, and pisses off Max. Then Ray and Helen come up, and Max tries to kind of inject himself into the group, which pisses off Barry. and he yells at him, "Yo, chumbait, take a hike," and throws him into some bikers.
Because he's got to show that he's got the biggest cock.
Well, then the bikers throw him back into Barry, and Max is ready to throw down. Like Maurice was saying, he wasn't just cowering in fear. He was ready to sock him one. And right. Then, what's that?
Right.
Oh, yeah. And then, you know, Ray breaks it up, and, you know, Max kind of stands there looking sulky, and Helen suggests that they take a joyride down to Dawson's Beach, which it's like, all right, you know, Gillespie did the, it was a joyride movie, and then Kevin Williamson wrote Dawson's Creek, so it's kind of funny.
Exactly. Dawson's Beach is down the road from yes. Dawson's Creek. I don't want to wait for our loves to be over. Okay.
So yeah, so they you know, take off. Julie clearly feels bad for Max. Like, she kind of gives him one last lingering look. And then we see the group erratically driving through the hills by the beach, like where we panned by earlier. And we cut to the beach at night, and they're telling the urban legend of the hook hand, you know, story. Where, and then none of them can get it right. You know, it's the hook is jammed in the car, the guy has been decapitated. Like, they're just all over the board telling the story. And now we kind of, a little time has passed. We cut to drunk Barry and Helen climbing on top of him, telling him about.
Oh, my God. So after I land my 2-year contract on Guiding Light, which I think is funny, because the first thing I ever saw Sarah Michelle Gellar in was the soap opera All My Children. She played a character named Kendall, who was Erica Kane, who was one of, like, the main characters for, like, the 700 years the soap opera was on. Her daughter that she had as a teenager and gave her up. And Kendall was this really evil, conniving, like, she was supposed to be 16 and, like, trying to sleep with her mother's husband.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. So I just thought it was funny that she's like, when I signed my contract for Guiding Light, she was on All My Children, and you just finished your season as quarterback for the Steelers. Does she say the Steelers and then he corrects her, or does she say something else and he's like, you mean the Steelers?
I honestly didn't write it down.
I don't know, yeah. But he's in college, and there's no one with the nickname of Steelers in college that I know of.
No, because she's talking about, like, eventually after she makes a name for herself and he graduates, and he's going to be an NFL quarterback.
Yeah, she's talking about their future.
Do you remember what team it was that he was going to play for, or she said he was going to play for?
I don't. I'm actually, hang on one sec. I did write it down somewhere because I'm weird and obsessed with this movie.
I don't feel bad. I got like 14 pages of notes.
This is really going to bother me if I don't answer this. This is a lost cause. It's buried.
It's okay. No worries. Like, if you truth. Find it, if you find it, just yell it out. Just yell out Steelers. Okay. And we'll come back to it.
Like a bad case of Tourette's.
Exactly. Okay. And then Julie decides that her and Ray are going to go walking. And what did we learn in Jaws? Bad shit happens. So this is so funny because Julie is like she's the quintessential virgin. Mm-hmm. Wearing the white.
Jennifer Love Hewitt is a virgin in every movie she's in.
Mm-hmm.
It was Cowboys.
Cowboys. There you
Cowboys.
Go.
She says Steelers and he corrects her to Cowboys. And then she says, well, whoever.
Yeah. They both thank suck. You.
Well, then she also mentions how she'll let him impregnate her with one of three kids.
Yes. My God. Like, just, you may. I'm thinking in my head, like, you may come inside me now.
Exactly. But you were saying about Julie, because I got some shit to say here, so go ahead.
So her and Fred, I mean Ray, are sitting on the sand, like walking, they walk hand in hand, they sit down in the sand, and like they're having this like this little chit chat, and she's looking all virginal and her hair is like nice and fluffy, like she used, you know, herbal essences in the 90s. And she decides, she takes her sweater off, and Ray's like, are you sure? And do you know what the subtitle said?
What's that?
It said, Julie decides sand in her vajayjay is a good way to lose her V card.
Oh my God. Okay. So yes, I agree. They're talking, Ray and Julie, and he's basically, they're talking about how they're going to two different schools. He's going to New York, and I forgot where she was going, but they're going away to their two different schools, and he's trying to convince her to come to New York City with him. And then he goes, did you know the success rate of high school sweetheart relationships is higher than any other type of relationship? And she goes, yeah, cite your source. And he just holds his hand over his heart, and she's like, fuck me right now. Like, I fucking lost it. Because he's like, are you sure? And she's like, just taking off clothes. And then I wrote, we pan across the beach while teens fucking get sand in their holes.
So did she, like, put the little mini cardigan she was wearing down on the sand, hoping, like, under her bum? Like, hoping that the sand wouldn't get in her vajayjay? Because I imagine that would cause some kind of an infection.
Well, she looks pretty grumpy in the next scene, so I don't think so.
No, but then she looks at him, and have you seen... Have all three of you seen Game of Thrones?
I have not.
I have. Seen a couple yes, episodes. I have.
So, have you seen the meme with Khaleesi, and it's Ser Jorah saying, let me fight for you, Khaleesi, and then it's just a picture of her with, like, her eyes squinted, and it says, let me fight for you, Khaleesi. I feel like every time Jennifer Love Hewitt smiles, she looks like that meme. Just, like, squinted eyes, like, duck lips, like, I love you so much, Ray.
You got sent in my vagina.
Exactly.
Oh, my God. So they end up leaving, and Barry is drunk as fuck and pissed off that they won't let him drive because no one drives his car but him. And so they get in, and Ray has some soft rock playing, and Barry's like, this is bullshit, and flips it over to radio-friendly hard rock, and then jumps out of the freaking... the moon roof, and he's got his booze, and he's screaming and hooting and hollering as they're driving around the cliffs. He drops the booze in all over Ray, and who takes his eyes off the road for a minute. He yells, watch out, right as a hobo crosses the road. I know it's not a hobo, but in my mind it was a hobo.
So here's my question about this, that very quick shot of them colliding with the human.
Yes.
Barry, like, flings forward and then back. How did he not go flying out of the car? How did he not get hurt?
Right.
And how the fuck did Goulash Face Man end up back in front of the car when he went up over the hood? Did, like, Barry, like, slingshot him backward with his, like, football prowess?
Because he hit Barry in the face, which cracked me the fuck up. I'm like, dude, you just got hit by a hobo. Like,
but did he have a shotgun?
No, unfortunately. But so, yes, they slam into this guy. Barry was fine. Like, that's the thing that gets me. He had no injury whatsoever. You were just hit in the face by a human body.
An adult male human body.
Right. Like, you would at least have a broken nose, if not a broken neck, you know?
And he's more concerned about the blood on his sweater and my car.
Oh, God. Yeah, he was like, oh, my God, my dad's going to kill me. So they're looking for whatever they hit. They're trying to figure it out. They're like, maybe it was a deer. What was it? And then Julie finds the bloody boot. Like, they hit him so hard, they knocked him clean out of his boot. And so they get some flashlights and look around. They eventually find the guy by the side of the road.
With goulash face.
Right. And they're freaking out. They're like, you know, oh, my God, you know, is he dead? Ray checks his pulse and says, I think so. So, like, right here, they should have been calling the cops. But, of course, they're panicking. And so they're like, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? The girls all want to call for help. And the guys are like, oh, let's think this through. You know, we were drinking. They're going to think, you know, that you know, Barry was driving and he's drunk and he's going to go to jail and blah, blah, blah. So I'm sorry, this conclusion, it's like they decide, let's just dump the body. Like,
so up till this point. It's much like Tucker and Dale. It really is just a big misunderstanding.
Right.
Because Ray's freaking out, and because Julie's like, you're sober, you're the one driving. He's like, Julie, there's booze all over the car.
Yeah.
Barry is totally shit-faced. So who are they going to believe? And then Ray's also freaking out because the other three of them, they come from money, and Ray's like the poor white trash boy who got in with the rich kids.
Yeah, he's the son of a fisherman.
Right.
So they end up, you know, saying that they're going to end up dumping, they need to dump the body. And this is where Julie notices the tattoo on the guy's arm. That just said Susie, right?
Yeah, it had my name. He's got my name tattooed on his arm.
So they pick up the body and they start to move it right as another car starts coming down the road. And, you know,
you're right? This part is so fucking ridiculous.
Oh, it really is.
Because they find out it's Max. They dump him over the guardrail. Barry's leaning over there. Not one fucking one of them even act like they're innocent. Yeah. They're all like, well, you know, Barry got sick. And he's like, over the guardrail. And it was so unbelievable.
Yeah. It was pretty damn dumb. But so Julie, you know, uses her wiles on him. And he gets a little gorsh and drives away. Because he's got a thing for Julie.
She's the Max Whisperer.
So they end up going down to the docks to dump the body. And they debate one last time before dumping the body in the water. You know, it's not too late to call the cops. We should call the cops. Nobody but Julie really wants to do that. And then she's like, should we check his wallet so we know who he is? No one wants to know. And they're like, no, we just need to do this and be done with it. So Helen is like, screw it. I'm going to do it. And she starts to roll the body in. And the guy wakes up and grabs her crown. Barry punches him and they roll him into the water.
He's not dead yet, but he's got her crown.
Right. And that's the thing. We see the slow sinking. He's holding the crown above water and slowly sinks in. And so Barry freaks out, jumps into the water, and suddenly he's swimming around in a tank on a soundstage. Because that was clearly not the ocean.
Right.
So he finds Hobo McNot dead. And he's just, the guy's floating there. He grabs the crown, struggles to get it away from him, and the guy opens his eyes. Barry screams and swims away with the crown. He comes out and acts like everything is fine. So they make a pact to never speak of this again and take it to their graves. Julie is the only one that seems a little hesitant. And so Barry fucking threatens her. Like, he like pushes her up against a car and is raising his fist like he's going to pummel her. I'm like, you fucking suck. He's such a dick. But, yeah, they all agree. And then we get the close-up on the charm that the drunk guy was holding in the beginning, laying in the dirt by the docks. So then we cut to 1 year later at college.
Wah, wah, wah. And Julie looks like she's been on the H train for 3 days.
Yes.
She went from Pantene hair to baby girl need a shower.
Well, even her roommate, what'd she say, like, zombie or dead looking ass or something?
Yeah, she said, get your dead ass. She says something like, get your dead looking ass in the car.
Something like that, yeah.
Because she doesn't want to go home for summer.
Yeah. So, yeah, when we see her, she's looking all zombified and typing on what looks to be like an ancient laptop. And her roommate is like, you know, I'm going to drive you home for the summer, blah, blah, blah. So she takes Julie home, drops her off in front of her mom's house. And her mom comes out to welcome her home. And then we cut to dinner with mom. And she's talking about, she's like, how do you like the snapper? I wanted mudfish. It's just random dialogue. I like cheese, you know.
Yes.
And then she just goes out of nowhere. She's like, are you on drugs? And she's like, wait, what? And she goes, I wanted an honest answer. I wanted to surprise you. And she's like, no, I'm not on drugs. She's like, then what's wrong? And she won't talk to her. So then her mom tells her that she got a letter. And Julie looks at the letter, and it just, you know, simply is titled, it says Julie James on it. Doesn't have, like, a return address or anything. She opens it up, and it's a note that simply says, I know what you did last summer. So she freaks out, asks her mom who sent it. Her mom doesn't know, and then goes, well, why? What does it say? And she's like, oh, nothing, and she scampers upstairs. So we cut to later that night in her room, and she's just staring at the note. She hears noises outside. Looks out into the darkness. We don't see anything. And then she just closes the window and goes to bed.
I'd like to point something out.
What's that?
Let's revisit my pet peeves. Sensible footwear. Fire hazards. And what wasn't there on the window?
No screen.
Fucking screen.
Exactly.
How are there not cicadas crawling up in her vajayjay now?
Yeah. So the next morning,
there's actually something This is the peanut gallery again. when you look, when the shack goes out the window, you hear the little trinket, the stupid little
The medallion.
You hear it. You hear it chime, which I would take to imply that he's watching her out there.
See, I just assumed that someone was watching because we saw the shot from outside.
Yeah, that too.
I didn't even notice the chime sound, but it's funny because, like, I noticed it later in the movie, like, because there's a couple other times we hear it, but especially at the end, we hear the chime. But yeah, I didn't even notice it there. That's a good catch. But, so we cut to the next day, and she's driving up to Main Street, and Great Life is playing while she looks like she's having a horrible life, which is pretty funny. And then she goes into a store on Main Street, and it's run by Bitchy McGee, a.k.a. Elsa.
She's a real bitch.
She really is. She's trying to be a bitch throughout this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Which is Helen's sister. And Julie asks her for Helen's phone number in New York. And she tells her there's no number. Just look 10 feet to your left at the fragrance counter. And we see Helen is working there at the store. So Julie goes over to Helen. They have their little, you know, reunion. And she shows her. Oh, God.
Helen's like, it didn't work out in NYC, in New York City. So translation, she wouldn't do butt stuff.
I wasn't expecting that.
She was like, nope, I draw a line.
No butt stuff for Helen.
Helen, no butt.
they kind of like, you know, awkwardly talk about what they've been up to. And then Julie shows Helen the note she received. And now we get red herring number two, because Elsa creepily watches from behind, like, oh, what are they up to? What are they discussing? So, you know, it's kind of forcing you to question, is she up to something? So then they decide to go see Barry and show him the note. And he comes to his little balcony and is a total douchebag to him. And then we cut to them all on like the balcony there talking,
and he's drinking straight vodka.
Yeah, and acting like a total dickbag, you know. And I don't know, Ryan Phillippe was really overacting in my opinion. Like he was just enraged constantly. Like he was like that guy from Toxic Avenger.
I just fucking hate him.
He was like flipping shit.
I think he was uncomfortable. Because only Justin Timberlake could really pull off tight curls like that in the late 90s. I think it hurt his head.
It was putting strain on his scalp.
Yeah, he was uncomfortable. And I didn't necessarily think that Elsa may have been up to something. I just think that she hates her sister so much that she's pissed off that her high school best friend actually came to look for her.
I mean, that's probably what it was, but I felt like the movie constantly gives us those lingering shots of I feel like the point was to make us go like, oh, are they the killer? Because especially at the time, these whodunits, I love a good whodunit, but they really liked to give you red herrings after the first scream. Once Scream came out, it was like every one of these movies had red herring after red herring after red herring, to the point where, like, if you were paying close enough attention, you could start spotting all the red herrings, you know, it was like before they even revealed that they were false leads. So Julie tells both of them that she had found out who the guy was. She said his name was David Egan. He was found 3 weeks after and then she goes, his body was caught in a shrimp net not far from Miller's dock. She goes, it was in the paper. I think police called it an accidental drowning. You can call it an accident all you want, but he died because of us. That's for certain. So Barry asks if she has shown Ray the letter. And this is where we find out that she hasn't talked to Ray because they broke up. So Barry thinks it's Max fucking with them since he was the only other person that saw them that night. So we cut to the docks. Barry is leading Helen and Julie over to where Max works. And he comes in. He's such a bitch. He comes in and talks to Max and he's all sheep. But she's like, hey, man, can we talk for a minute? Can we talk alone? And he's like, all right, whatever. And he goes, talks to him in the back room. And he just, like, throws Max against the wall and starts threatening to beat the shit out of him. And then grabs a fucking fisherman's hook. And it's like, did he cut his hand or his face with it? He, like, cuts him for a second.
I think it's his cheek, yeah.
That's like, you dick. And, you know, and then he leaves and he's like, he won't be bothering us anymore. It's like, you're such a dick. But as they're leaving, they randomly run into Ray, and who's now a fisherman and not living in New York City like everyone thought. So, ooh, is he the killer? They make Ray out to be the killer a couple times.
Yeah.
But so Ray wants to talk to Julie, and Barry first mocks Ray for being a fisherman, and then bails. And then Ray wants to talk to Julie, and Helen bails. So he's like, he says to Julie, he goes, look, I thought a lot about last summer. I know you hold me responsible for what happened. And she says, I don't hold you responsible. No, I'm responsible for my own actions, and I don't blame you, but I don't want to know you either. And she takes off. I just wrote, ouch.
Seriously.
But, so we cut back to pissed off Max working, and he slams the hook into the ice block that was kind of in the back room. There was all these ice blocks. And he goes to the crab steamery. Because there's all those giant steamer pots and he's throwing crabs in. And he burns his hand and goes to get some gloves. And when he goes to get the gloves, we see that the hook is now gone. So dun, dun, dun. And someone is watching him from beyond the steam. And he sees him. He's like, you know, who is that? Who's over there? And then suddenly the hook swings up, slams into Max's jaw. And he gets dragged off camera, leaving a trail of blood. So bye bye, Max. David is no
more. Now, it would have been a better killing if you would have dipped them in the water.
True.
Like a teabag?
Sure. You could have teabagged them.
That's some Jason-level killing right there. But, so now we cut to Barry pulling up to the gym at night. And we get the workout montage, and I wrote Even Rocky Had a Montage. Yep. So then we get Barry is in the shower and he hears a noise. He's like, hello? Nothing's there. So now he goes to the locker room and we see a Polaroid picture of his car in the parking lot hanging out of his locker, and on the back it's written, I know. So now he gets pissed off and starts storming through the locker room, can't find anybody. He hears a noise at the other end. He goes running back and his locker is now open and his jacket is gone. So he quickly gets dressed, asks the clerk who else is there, and he says no one but them. And then he hears his car start up outside. So he goes running after it. The driver, whoever's in the car, is driving backward down the road. Barry is chasing after the car. Then the car hits the brakes. Barry stops, and it turns on the headlights and starts driving at him. And I just wrote, serpentine, Barry, serpentine.
How does nobody hear this?
Yeah, exactly. There's nobody there.
And furthermore, why is Barry wearing dog tags?
It was a 90s thing, apparently, that we missed out on.
Apparently.
I was trying, for the love of all that was holy, to figure that out. Because I noticed that, like, right off the bat, when they first see him at the house, he's suddenly wearing dog tags. And this is going nowhere. I couldn't figure it out. The book does have to do with military vets.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that was like a nod to that or whatever, or and so it was the 90s, so that it was just cool to wear dog tags. I have no idea.
He traded in those little silver anal beads for dog tags.
God. I remember those gigantic necklaces.
Yup. Oh man.
But you got kids wouldn't know about that. And the dog tags being cool.
That's true. I see. Yeah, we weren't into that. But so now the car is chasing Barry, and it hits him and slams him through a wall of, like, you know, what was it, like a garage or something, a dock?
Yeah.
And so Barry goes flying. He's all fucked up. The car stops, and the guy gets out, and we see it's a guy in a slicker. So this is our first look at the Gordon's fisherman. And Barry but starts. Oh God!
He's got a popped collar.
Yes, so
like
he can't see
his face.
One of the
Gotties.
And then Barry starts apologizing and begging for his life, and you see the fisherman brandish the hook, and then we cut to black. So now we cut to the hospital, and we see Julie, Ray, and Helen show up, freaking out. They go to Barry's room, and now we kind of get like a little quick time pass. We see that they've been in there talking to him. And Barry assures them that if the guy wanted him dead, he could have killed him. He said, he's messing with me. And then they're like, well, what did he look like? He said, the only thing I know for sure is that he was in a slicker, which, you know, considering it's a fishing town, that's a bit of a problem. And then out of nowhere, Barry's like, he looks at Ray, he's like, hey, you got a slicker. And it's like, oh, okay. So yeah, the one guy that you personally know must be the killer because exactly. The rest of the town doesn't have a fucking slicker.
Also, why is that hospital straight out of the 1930s?
Yeah, true.
Like that elevator, I don't know if I would have trusted it. Also, so they leave.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, Ray and Julie have another exchange, and Julie gets pissed off, and she's like, fuck it, I'm just going to take the stairs. And it looked like when she flung the door open and ran out to go down the stairs, that mm-hmm. the staircase going up just ended at like a wooden door.
Probably did.
It's a really small town. There's not a big budget.
Now, I have a question here though. Why were they not being quiet at all while they were walking through, like walking to leave? They were like, well, nobody knows we killed the guy. It's like, they're not being quiet. There's people everywhere.
And I think that we've all learned from other movies that in a small town, everybody's listening.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I just found that part really funny.
So but, you know Mabel Black Label sitting at the reception desk.
Oh, yeah.
Picked she up heard. All of that.
So now they talk about, doing some research on David Egan. They're like, maybe it has to, or maybe it's a friend or a family member. So we cut to Julie and Helen doing research on him, and they find an article from 2 years earlier about an accident that killed a woman named Susie Willis, and Egan was the driver, but he was unharmed. And then Julie remembers seeing a girl's name tattooed on the dead guy's arm, so she remembers seeing the name Susie on his arm. So they're like, you know, it must have been him. So they see that David was survived by his mother and sister and decide to go talk to them. So they go out to the boonies and find the Egan's residence and knock on the door.
Egan. You
know, what's that?
Egan.
No, not
Negan. Egan. And, Mike, I'm surprised Egan. You didn't mention this.
What's
so
that?
They're driving, and Helen and Julie are talking about, okay, so what's our plan?
Yeah.
What's our game plan? And Julie's like, I don't know, we're going to wing it. And Helen says, Angela Lansbury always had a plan.
Yeah.
There's our Murder, She Wrote connection.
Mm-hmm. I forgot to write that down, but as soon as you started talking, I'm like, oh, shit, I remember what you... Yeah, I should have put that in the notes. But you're right. We do have a Murder, She Wrote connection this time around.
That's her code name, too.
Yes. Because she calls her, was it Angela?
Jody and Angela. Angela.
Yeah. Because she made the comment of, we're just going to go up and knock on the door. And she goes, that didn't work out too well for Jodie Foster.
Yes.
But so they knock on the door. No one's there. And then Julie like climbs up and starts peering in the windows. And we meet Missy Egan. She jumps out and she's like, can I help you?
She looks like a cannibal.
Yeah, she
looks like she belongs in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
She does. She looks like that skinny lady from the remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yes.
So they kind of spin a tale about their car broke down and they need to use a phone to call AAA. And so they go inside, and this is where they give her the fake names. They, you know, refer to themselves as Jody and Angela. And so Judy tells Helen to go call AAA, and Helen turns to use the phone and immediately walks face first into a giant black slicker. It's like, dun, dun, dun. Could it be Missy? It's like, they all have fucking slickers. So the woman finally introduces herself as Missy Egan. And we find out, she's asked her if she lives here alone. And she says, yeah, you know, her dad died and her mom ended up in a home after what happened. Well, you know, and then they kind of talk a little bit about David. So basically her mom went a little cuckoo after David died. And, so Missy offers to make them some tea while they wait for AAA. And Helen pretends like she remembers David from school and says, that, oh, he used to hang out with that one guy. Oh, you know, that guy. And Misty's like, oh, I never really knew any of David's friends. So then she goes, oh, well, there was this one guy who came to pay his respects. Real nice guy. I feel like we hit it off. And they're like, what was his name? And she just kind of looks off and says, Billy Blue. And it's like, yeah, that's not an alias for anything.
Billy Blue Balls.
Exactly. So then they decide to go wait in the car, and they kind of discuss what happened and how, you know, they accidentally killed a man and ended up ruining the lives of everybody he knew. And then we get the Missy jump scare. She, like, jumps up. She's like, hey, you forgot your cigarettes. Like, scares the shit out of both of them. And then she goes, oh, I see you got the car started. And they're like, yeah, damnedest thing. It started right up. She goes, funny how that happens. And then they drive away while she creepily watches. So red herring number three.
She just doesn't have any social skills, because she even says, and I understand, I do agree, red herring. Mm-hmm. But she's like, people don't really come around. She says something like, people don't really come around here no more.
Yeah, like she gets no visitors. So, and I mean, it's pretty sad, actually. You know, she lives there by herself, you know, out in the middle of nowhere.
Just but, her and her animal carcasses. Carcai.
Her and her shower butthole.
I don't understand this reference. What, this was to Psycho?
Yeah, there's... Okay, so have you seen the Psycho remake?
I have many, no pun intended, moons ago.
Well, there's a few things that they... Even though it was a quote-unquote shot-for-shot, there were a few things they added. Like the fact that Norman was masturbating and watching her in the shower. Like, there was little things like that. But the murder scene where she's, you know, slashed by Norman in the shower, she falls forward and, like, is hunched over the tub. So, like, she's, like, flopped on the floor, and her ass is sticking, like, straight up. And the angle in which they film it at is a top-down angle. So you just get direct view of Brown Eye, and it's like, when you see that on the big screen, it leaves a mark.
You know, I remember seeing that in the theater, too, and wow, I don't remember that. That doesn't sound very flattering at all.
No, it's really not.
To say the least.
I remember when I saw it in the theater, everyone started fucking laughing. They were like, oh my god.
That whole remake was kind of a joke, so.
Honestly, I've only seen it twice. I saw it in the theater, and then I saw it again when it came out on video, and I'm like, yeah, I dislike it as much as I liked it, or as much as I disliked it the first time around.
Yep.
So, but, yeah, so they end up driving back, and they discuss needing to find Billy Blue. And then Helen kind of comes out with, she's like, well, maybe he wanted to die. And she goes, what? She goes, David Egan, his girlfriend was killed on that same road 1 year earlier. Maybe he blamed himself. Maybe he was waiting on the road for us to hit him. And then Julie goes, yeah, if that helps you sleep at night. And that's when she's like, what happened to us? And she's all sad about their friendship. And Julie is like, you know, fuck it. I'm out.
Yeah, because Helen goes, I miss you. And Julie was just like, yeah, well, you know, now I look strung out and you had to do porn in New York. So we won't talk about it.
And there's then, something that whole part is like profoundly depressing to me. It
really is. It's sad. Well, because I think everybody has had like at least one or two friends that like they were really close with for a short period of time, like intensely close with, and then they drift apart. And it's like, it's sad when that happens, you know, because, and sometimes, I mean, sometimes it's for, you know, some bad shit happened, and other times it's just, you know, life got in the way and you kind of went in different directions, and either way, it's depressing.
Right. I mean, I understand and have experienced the drifting apart, but the bad shit, like, I've never killed somebody with my friends.
Oh, you haven't lived.
Apparently not.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, like, you know, a bad argument or something that. Right, but, you know, I can't say that I've quite experienced this level of trauma. But, yeah, so Julie speeds off. Helen goes in her house. And we see drunk dad just watching TV and ignoring her.
Oh, he was drunk?
Yeah, he had a glass in his hand with some amber-colored liquid in it.
I didn't even notice that. I just wrote, is dad a mute?
Yeah, he might as well have been in a coma. Like,
okay, that makes much more sense now that he ignored her, because he's probably so drunk he's like, is it coming from the TV or what's going on?
Where am I?
Right, but then the fucking Gorton's fisherman just waltzes into Helen's house.
Yep,
and goes upstairs, like, and then I love this because she goes in the kitchen after her dad doesn't acknowledge her, mm-hmm. gets a Diet Coke.
Sweet product placement.
And then the glass is flipped upside down on the table, you know, because apparently people can't raise their arms and open a cupboard.
Right.
And then she, like, looks like she's going to pour it. And then she's like, fuck it. I'm just going to go upstairs and go to bed. And as she's walking, like, back, I love this part. He's walking upstairs and just goes into her room. And mm-hmm. she turns the corner just as he turns the corner. And then yeah. she walks in her room and you think, he's going to get her there, but no. And then the closet door is open a little bit. So you think he's trapped in the closet.
Exactly. He's pulling an R. Kelly. And
I hope not.
Yeah. R. Kelly minus the sex slaves.
Yes. Minus the really, well, I don't know. Trapped in the closet was pretty creepy. So I was going to say minus the creepy, but that video.
Minus the golden showers.
Yes.
Yes. Oh,
horrifying. But so now Helen is kind of just like in her room looking around and she sees her crown and kind of gets a little bummed out, you know, and then Bitchy McGee comes in and starts telling Helen how she needs her to be at the store tomorrow. And she says she can't because she has to be in the parade and the pageant. And she said that it's tradition for the previous year's queen to be there. And then Bitchy berates her, like, you know, well, dad left me in charge and you're supposed to be there, blah, blah, blah. And Helen starts brushing her hair and she's like, oh, you and your hair, and just walks out. Like, she's such a horrible person in this movie.
Yep.
And
don't worry, she gets hers.
Oh, yeah. Pretty quickly, too. But then we cut to the next morning. Helen wakes up and the crown is on her head and she's kind of confused and she starts realizing that her hair has been chopped off into a stylish do. I wrote, how, oh, humanity.
How did he chop her hair without waking her up and put the crown on her? Like, did she take drugs before she went to sleep? Did yes. he somehow yes, drug her?
That's part of her nightly routine to forget about the New York City stuff.
And, you know, that what she did last summer. I get exactly. it. Okay, it makes sense now. But it looks, it's just so horrible. And then it's jagged and uneven. And then the next time we see her, she's wearing a cap.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. So let's keep going.
Well, she sees written on her mirror in lipstick. It just says soon. And she freaks out and starts punching the glass until it breaks. So then Julie gets a call from Helen. And I wrote, Julie hops in the Julie mobile and is off. And she's driving along. And she starts hearing these sounds coming from her trunk. So she pulls over and goes to check her trunk. And she opens it and finds about $1,000 worth of crabs and a dead Max. And she freaks the fuck out, you know, because there's a little crab crawling out of the Max mouth. And she runs to Helen's house. So Barry's already there talking to Helen. Julie convinces them to come with her so they can go check the trunk. And of course, they get there and it's completely gone. It's completely cleaned up. There's, you know, just a
which
couple
is
of
bullshit.
Thank you. I was like, there is no way he had time to take a fucking shop vac to that carpet in there.
This is the first of several times that mm-hmm. I say, how did he clean it up and get rid of the body so quickly? Those crabs were alive. You know, yes. they're pinching him.
Oh, yeah. And there was, like I said, there was tons of them in there. So, first of all, there would have been, like, some seawater, you know, because they were all, like, wet looking. You know, there could have been blood. Like, he had to get all of that out of there and then clean up the fucking carpet in there because it was one of those carpeted trunks.
Right. But did he maybe put down a tarp that we didn't see because of all the crabs? And then he just gathered it up and with his superhuman Gorton fisherman strength lifted it up. And put it in the back of his Aquamobile?
Yes.
I like that theory.
So, I have a question for you guys in general. Like, so, like, in slasher movies and stuff, and I like, that sort of scene, like, I can always, like, bypass, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, when you're watching, this is probably a stupid question, but I'm sure no everybody likes, thing. Like, the Friday the 13th movies.
Oh, yes.
And those are, you know, I mean, they literally made it in a video game where Jason has a teleportation superpower.
Yep.
And so, like, I know when I watch certain movies, there are little, like stuff like that where I'm just like, oh, for the love of God, why? Like, yep. That just defies physics, most, like, logic. And I get where that scene does entirely that, but it doesn't bother me. And I just, like, I know there's, like, a threshold on that. Like, when I watch Friday the 13th movies, because those are more like, well, I mean, without those, there wouldn't be this. Or that type of movie. Like, and now in 2020, especially, where they're almost like kids' toys, like, and because of Scream, where Scream opened up a lot of doors for, like, horror, where it's like, oh, I can kind of act, but Scream was also, I thought the opening of Scream, at least, was very scary, but, like, also opened that door to being like, oh, I can be smarter than the movie.
Right.
You know what I mean? Not, and I'm not saying, like, a nitpicky way, but for, like, the general public to be like, oh, well, I kind of get what that's all about. Like, they're talking about Nightmare on Elm Street. I know what Nightmare on Elm Street is, but I wouldn't watch it seriously. And if I did,
yep,
I'd have to, you know. But, like, I know it gets kind of compartmentalized. And I know this, like, I remember my one buddy and I were talking about this scene. And we were like, wow, that, even for us, that kind of takes the cake. But we were still, like, scared of the movie. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That's one of the things we say on this show all the friggin' time is, like, when you watch a movie critically, you notice things that you never really noticed or even cared about in the past. Especially when we cover a Friday the 13th movie. I mean, we usually end up tearing those films apart, even though we all have this, like, deep-rooted love for those movies. But, yeah, I mean, there definitely is a threshold of, like eye rolling material where you hit a point where it's like, oh, come the fuck on. Like, how is that possible?
Like, yeah. In the one special with the one Friday the 13th special, the walking on the hands machete, like, to the dick.
Yes.
Oh, that's,
we were
great.
Like, Jason put some kitty litter down, rolled up the carpet, put a new one down. It's all good.
Yeah. He cleaned up that corpse and blood so damn quick. It's like, wait a second. How is that possible? Oh, good.
Sorry. No, oh, no. I was going to say, like, and even now, too, and, like, and there's not, I mean, most of them are, I don't know, I feel like it's harder when it's more modernized, almost. Do you know what I mean? Like,
oh, yeah.
When you're doing stuff and it's better acted and, like, the production value is higher and then you pull one of those, it's like, I don't know if you can.
Well, and that's the thing. We also have to remember the time frame in which we were watching this originally, because back in the 90s, this whole whodunit teen slasher was kind of a new thing, because the previous generation of slasher movies were things like Halloween, Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street. You know, we knew who the killer was every time. You know, it's like, aside from Friday the 13th Part 1 and 2, after that, we knew who Jason was. We knew Jason was the killer. Like, it became a level of, like, meta awareness where, like, the characters within the film knew he was coming back from the dead all the time, you know? So it was like, those were the types of slasher movies we were used to. Once Scream came out, it kind of flipped the script and was like, well, anybody could be the killer, but who is it? And we accepted that at the time, where it was just, like, par for the course of, like, these killers doing the kind of supernatural level things that the last grouping of slashers were doing, but with this more realistic modern twist. And I feel like when we go back and watch them now, I know, at least for me, when I go back and watch them now, I always notice those types of moments, but there's that nostalgic factor that Susie was talking about at the start, at least for me, where when I watch these films, I'm like, you know what? I give it a pass, even though I'm calling bullshit on it. I still give it a pass and I'm enjoying myself, but I do notice it is bullshit.
I think, too, this, and this probably has to do with, you know, obviously reaching a certain age or something, too. Like, but do you guys, I get this sense, like, like, even slap. No. No. like, even though some slashers are scary the first time you watch it, or there's parts in it that certainly jolt you, like, I feel at the same time they become, and it's almost like the bad part of Friday the 13th and that 80s boom, like you go watch a slasher almost to watch, and I'm not saying this in regards to content at all, but like to watch like a safe horror movie. Like I feel like as more and more are getting made, like they're almost playing it safe in some way, and I can't quite grip it. It's kind of almost like, you know, is there only so many more, you know, tricks you can do or so many times you can see it? I don't know. I still love them and I will still always watch them, but I'm just curious what your guys' thoughts on that are. If there could be like, or if there was recently like one that kind of got under your skin, that was in like a Friday the 13th kind of vein without being like jokingly aware of what it was, like, oh, I'm the jock, I'm the bimbo, or whatever they're, you know, those stereotypes in the 80s were.
I can't really think of one that uses all the tropes that
or maybe didn't use any tropes too.
The one I can think of that genuinely got under my skin is actually from the early 2000s, and it's a movie called The Last Horror Movie.
Yes. We talked about this.
We do need to eventually get it on this show because I do still say it is genuinely frightening, especially if you actually get in the right mood to watch this film. Like if you're engaged in the movie, you know, you're not kind of like, you know, playing on your phone while you're watching it or talking to other people. If you're engaged in the film, it's very scary because it starts off so basic and so easy where it's like this cheesy looking bad filmed slasher movie where there's a girl cleaning a diner and this like escaped convict comes up behind her and slashes her throat. And then suddenly the screen goes fuzzy and you see a point of view shot and it's, you know, much better film quality. And you see a guy sleeping in a subway, like a hobo sleeping. The camera gets set down and you see somebody, whoever was carrying the camera, picks up like a chunk of cement and bashes the head in of this sleeping hobo. Like brutally murders him and then turns the camera on himself. And it's a normal looking guy, like a well put together guy. And he's talking right to you as the viewer. He goes, "Hi there. Do I have your attention?" And he starts talking about, like, you know, I bet you're wondering, is this a movie or did I just really kill that guy? And then he makes you question, why are you watching this? And the entire time you're watching him commit murder and he's talking to you as the viewer and questioning your morals and questioning what you're doing. And I don't want to ruin the ending in case we do eventually cover it, but the ending sent shivers down my spine. And like when the credits rolled, I was looking around my house, like I was freaked the fuck out. Now granted, I was also younger. I saw this when I was like maybe 26. But still, I hold that movie up as a slasher movie that genuinely frightened me. Of the modern era, because I can go back, like Texas Chainsaw still freaks me out. The original Halloween I still find very creepy. The original Nightmare on Elm Street, all that stuff. But of the modern era, that's one slasher film that really did freak me out.
I have to check that one out. I've heard of it. I've never seen it. It sounds like what is his name? Michael Haneke. Have you guys ever heard of Funny Games?
Yes.
That's what it sounds a little bit like.
Yeah, Funny Games.
Similar to. I don't know if it's what it's like though.
That was also kind of scarring. It's similar in content as far as the violence, but definitely a different concept. But yeah, Funny Games is another one. That's a hard one to watch.
I feel like it's hard too to hit that sweet spot of something like the original Halloween where it was. And of course, there was that element of it being so fresh, like being one of the first ones to do it. But like of also being like kind of fun, too. You know, I don't know.
No, it's true. And I think most modern slashers that are successful, I know we're way off topic at the moment, but this is really. Oh, no. I'm really enjoying this conversation. But like the more modern films, the ones that I'm a fan of are the ones that do homage or reference the slasher genre, who are basically like, look, we know like, just come along with us on this ride. And my favorite example of it, and it's one of my top 10 favorite movies of all time, is Behind the Mask, The Rise of
Burn. Yeah.
I fucking adore that movie.
I probably so like good. That more than Scream.
Honestly. I agree. Like,
that movie is played so well.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm still upset to this day that we never got more, like, because they tried to do another film and it didn't get the funding. I love the fact that, because the other film franchise that came out at that time was Hatchet, and I love those movies. But in Hatchet 2, they actually reference Leslie Vernon in the same kind of vein of, like, how in Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street, like, everyone was kind of like, are these taking place in the same universe? And then eventually we find out they were. But I was so waiting for, like, a Hatchet and Vernon crossover. So I was like, oh, fuck, that never happened. But
I mean, it could. We saw Victor Crowley and how that ended.
True, true. But it's a matter of, can we get another Behind the Mask?
Right. For me, it was in just real quick before we get back on topic.
Mm-hmm.
It's the movie Would You Rather.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Found that movie incredibly original. I've seen it more than once. And every time I watch it, I'm just very uncomfortable. Just at, like, it really is, what is the lesser of the two evils? And then the end is just heart-wrenching. And yeah. I won't give it away, because maybe one day we can get that on the show. But that movie really, like, it hit a nerve with me. And if you haven't seen it, Eric, I recommend watching it.
Yeah, I have not. I've heard of that. Is that recent? Like, in the last couple of years?
2012. Oh, Jeffrey Combs is in it. And Brittany Snow and the dad from Home Alone and one of the guys from Trailer Park Boys.
This sounds perfect.
And I don't know if you watch Gotham, but the guy who played the Penguin is in it too. It's just, it's a great movie, but it struck a nerve with me, and I thought it was an original concept, and the ending was just, the first time I watched it, after it ended, I just sat there for a couple minutes like, what the fuck just happened? Like, I can't believe this is how it ended.
Yeah. No, that's a fucked up movie. But yeah, before we get any farther, let's hop back on this. So basically after they check the trunk, they realize that, you know, it's bullshit. He's gone. You know, Julie's freaking out.
She says the quintessential scene. The quintessential part of the movie. What are you waiting for? And then she spins around and, like, thrusts her arms back like she's being sucked up by a beam of light.
It's the overhead, you know, helicopter shot.
Yes.
Not where it's from a helicopter, but where she's helicoptering with her arms.
Yes.
So they're freaking out because he's got him right where he wants him. And they go back to Helen's house, and now Ray is there. Barry sees him, runs up, and punches him in the face, accusing him of being behind it all. And I love this in these, particularly in these teen movies, where people just don't react after getting punched. Like, you get punched in the face, and they're just like, everybody's just fine after. I'm like, fuck that. If I get punched in the face, I'm going to be pissed.
Every movie I watch, though, like, if someone gets hit or cut, and they're just like, whatever, I'm like, oh my God, I'd be crying.
I know, right?
I want a binky and a blankie.
And then he goes, he's after me too, all right? I got a letter. And he goes, oh, you got a letter. I get run over. Helen gets her hair chopped off, and Julie gets a body in the trunk. You get a letter. Yeah, that's balanced. And then they tell Ray about how Max is dead. Barry taunts Ray some more, accusing him. Julie breaks it all up. And then Helen realizes that Elsa graduated the same year as David Egan. So they figure maybe they can get her yearbook and take it to Missy and have her point out this Billy Blue. And they realize, you know, it's probably a fake name. When they're talking about the name Billy Blue, Ray suddenly looks nervous. So then Julie says that she'll go out and ask Missy, and because Helen has to go to the pageant and the parade. So now she's freaking out because she doesn't want to do it. Barry says he'll be there with her to watch out for the guy. So we cut to the parade. Helen is atop the float looking for the fisherman while Barry sits at the bottom looking around as well. Then
Here's the thing with that. So Helen's hair looks like, I don't know, looks like jagged, jangly teeth. then she's on the float and all of a sudden it's nice and trimmed. And if you look, when she sits up in bed, and I know like your hair is all whatever when you wake up in the morning, but her hair is chopped like at different lengths, much shorter than her shoulders.
Yes.
And then magically, through the art of weaves,
it's movie magic.
It's a wig.
Probably.
So now she spots a fisherman kind of walking away in a slicker, and she points him out to Barry. He goes running after him and tackles this poor, like, 80-year-old man.
And then, like, he doesn't even fucking apologize for basically breaking the old man's hip.
The old man, he's like, rah, rah. He's like, don't hurt me.
He looks like he dies in the end.
I know, he looks terrified. So now we cut to Julie at Missy's place, and she can't find Missy again. And suddenly she appears with a knife and a bloody apron. She's like, what you want? What you doing here?
After Julie surveys the yard, which she didn't do the first time, and sees all of these, like, animal skulls and, like, turkey carcasses. And...
Right. And it's like, yeah, that's creepy. But so Missy jumps out with the knife, and then we cut to back to the parade. And we see Helen is just seeing men in slickers everywhere, and which I imagine has to be hot as fuck, considering this is the 4th of July.
Exactly.
But, so she spots a fisherman on the roof, and she looks up at him, and he brandishes the hook, and she realizes that's him. Then we cut back to Missy and Julie. Missy's gutting fish, and Julie wants her to look through the yearbook for Billy Blue. She explains to him, you know, like, we really need to talk to this guy. And she's like, no, I don't want nothing to do with it. And she says that her brother's death was not an accident or was not, sorry, was not a suicide. Cause earlier she had said her brother had committed suicide. I forgot to mention that. And, she's like, yes, it was. I have a note. And she gets the note that she hid from the insurance company. And, it simply says, I will never forget last summer. And Julie says, that's not a suicide note. That's a death threat. And then she says that she saw her brother. Missy doesn't believe him. And Julie's like, no, I saw him. He has he has tattooed on his arm the name of Susie. And then Missy's like, he didn't have a tattoo. And that's when she realizes, oh, it wasn't David that they hit. So we cut back to the pageant. Helen is freaking out about the hook man. And Barry tells her he'll be watching and not to be afraid. So she comes out on stage looking nervous, sees Barry up in the balcony, kind of gets put at ease. We get this horrible talent show.
Oh, my God. That was so fucking uncomfortable.
Oh, it really was.
I think she was singing the song from Fame, too.
Yes.
Oh, it was so bad.
Yeah, that's not talent.
No. That would be like if I were singing. It was so bad. But, Barry's watching from the balcony. Helen's looking around. She looks up at the balcony and she sees someone coming up behind him. She freaks out and screams. Barry's looking in the crowd like, where? So then Helen starts to rush off the stage in hysterics while Barry is like trying to figure out what the hell's going on. And then the fisherman grabs him and like drags him off. And now she's getting stopped by the crowd. Like, I don't understand why the crowd surrounded her and, like, kind of held her in place. Like, calm down, you dizzy dame. Like, what the fuck was going on there?
Well, they were all wearing their cock-a-mole hats or whatever it was called.
We have the giant fish hats?
Yeah.
And then we see up on the balcony, we see the fisherman knock Barry to the ground and start, like, bludgeoning him. And then we see the shadow of the hook raise and come down and starts killing Barry. So Helen's freaking the fuck out. They're all holding her in place. The cops show up. He's like, hey, what's going on? What's going on? Then she tells him there's someone being murdered up in the balcony. They go up there. Like, this was all in the matter of what? Like 30 seconds?
Yep.
And the body and the blood is gone. Except again, for a little bit of blood on the railing that they somehow missed.
That it's was like, just enough to drip as we're done with that scene.
Oh, that annoyed me. So
here's my next question. So this is all taking place during the day, but in the very next scene, it's nighttime. And 4th of July, nighttime is like 9 o'clock or later.
Right. Exactly. So
how long was she sitting there
before, in a comatose state?
Exactly. before the deputy was like, all right, I'll take you home now, but you got to sit in the back of the car.
Well, and the pageant's not even over because the showrunner is like, we'll be needing this. Thanks.
That's
and
just right. takes her crown. And she's like, oh, what are you doing?
So now while the cop is driving her home and she's in the back of the cop car, he's making fun of her hair. Like, I forgot what he said, but he's like teasing her about her hair being chopped off. It's like, what a dick. And then so he's driving. He sees that the road is blocked because of the parade. And he's like, oh, we got to take the alleyway. So Helen starts arguing with him, saying, she goes, look, you little shitstick Mayberry ass reject. There's been a murder and you're going to fry in hell if you ignore it. So the cop's like, yeah, yeah, we'll follow up with the kid's parents. Like, such a dick. So now they cut down the alleyway, and we see that someone has broken down in the alleyway, and the cop gets out to help. Helen notices it's the fisherman, and she screams. The cop turns and gets gutted by old fish sticks. So now Helen is trapped in the back of the cop car. Now this is also seen in Scream 2. Like, that happens in Scream 2 as well.
Oh, yeah.
But, she's freaking out, and unlike in Scream 2, she's able to break the back window in heels.
I read somewhere, and I have no idea if this is true, and I remember digging up the script for this movie somewhere, but I read somewhere that originally that Scream 2 cop car thing where the FBI guy or the two cops, they get the driver, they got killed, and then they got trapped in the car with the killer.
Mm-hmm.
I heard that was originally supposed to be in this movie with her in some way, and I don't know if that's true, but that was a internet rumor I felt I needed to share right now. But I that's something that I did find out, and it kind of seems to make sense now watching this.
That would make sense, you know, especially since, like, it did seem weird that the very next film that they, you know, that he did had this same scene, only different.
You know? Yeah.
It's like, yeah. All right. But so she's able to somehow boot out the window in heels. And then she escapes. And then we cut to Julie doing research. She finds she's doing research on Susie.
Let's back up for a second.
Oh, God.
How does she not fuck up her hands, her knees, and lower legs climbing out of the cop car, landing on all that glass?
Movie magic.
That's right.
I just want to point it out.
Yeah, no, that whole scene is really unbelievable, because it's like, you know, first of all, you're not going to be able to kick out the back window that easy. And, you know, second of all, you are wearing, you know, it basically like a slip kind of dress. Like, your knees are unprotected, your arms are unprotected, you're climbing through glass, you're falling out the car. Yeah, you'd be fucked up. But, whatever.
when we were talking about stuff before, like, I feel like that's the difference between like a 80s kind of slasher and then like Rob Zombie, who would have, like, I don't know, severed her foot getting out of the car or something like that. Like, or anybody else would maybe now. I don't know.
She would have been fucked up if this was a Rob Zombie movie.
My husband calls all Rob Zombie movies. Well, I don't know that he's seen all of them, but he says that it's murder porn.
And I like Rob Zombie's movies too.
Me too.
I don't know if that's sacrilege on the show, but I
no, I it's not. Him. I love him.
Oh no, we're
Yeah, I love everything about him. I want to be best friends with him and his wife. I want to go out on double dates and hang out.
And honestly, I mean, considering we've covered some doozies on here, but we pretty much are all of the mindset of, like, even if it's bad, it can be good. You know, like, because we've watched movies we've all agreed have been bad and still had fun talking about them. So, like, even if it's a movie that the general public is like, oh, that's garbage, chances are we're going to have fun talking about it.
Right.
Cool. Like Dolly Dearest, you know, all three of us were like, oh, that was trash, but we all loved talking about it. So now Julie's doing research on Susie. And finds out that her dad is alive and he's a fisherman. So now we cut to Helen running toward her family store, and Fish Sticks has given chase. And we see that Bitchy McGee is there. Helen starts pounding on the door, begging for her to open. And of course, she takes her sweet ass time walking to the door. Fish Sticks is getting closer. Bitchy realizes she needs the keys. She goes to get them. The killer's getting closer and closer. Finally, she opens the door. Helen scoots in right as, you know, the fisherman would have got her. And Bitchy complains, why didn't you just use the back door? Which now is really funny considering what you said, Susie, about her not doing any backdoor shenanigans. So Helen screams.
Maybe at, that's why she said it.
Yeah, she's like, it would have been in New York City still. That's all kinds of wrong.
And maybe this next part wouldn't have happened, so.
Yeah. So Helen screams at Bitchy to lock up, and she goes to call the cops. Now we cut to the back room, and we see the door just closing as Bitchy is walking up to lock the door. Now Fish Sticks walks up behind her. She sees him. She screams, and he slashes her, and we got dead Bitchy McGee. So Helen hears the scream and starts looking for her sister. Suddenly, the music that Bitchy had playing shuts off. She's looking around. Then the lights go out. She's looking around like, oh, what's going on? And somehow, old Fish Sticks is hiding under a plastic sheet, standing amidst the mannequins, but was still able to turn everything off. Like, yeah. How did that happen? Because the plastic would have made him. Yeah, right. He's pulling a full-on Jason here. Like, how did that happen? So Helen spots dead Elsa, screams. Fish Sticks jumps out from under the plastic and runs after her. And then she jumps on what was, it looked like a giant dumbwaiter. Like, was that supposed to be an elevator or something? Or
it,
was
it looked like a dumbwaiter, but because she had to pull herself up.
Yeah, but I'm thinking, like, was it like a dumbwaiter for like cargo or something to like stock? Maybe.
As far as I know, this is an actual store that they used to shoot this in.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an internet video where somebody visited the store and the store owner let them look around. And where Elsa's body is in the bathroom,
mm-hmm.
that's the real bathroom. And it probably, it looks like it hasn't been cleaned since I shot this movie. Like she was really leaning against the real toilet in there. And, but the, anyways, they found it. And one of the attractions was the elevator that they had. And apparently they didn't replace the rope. Like they didn't put like a soft rope in it. So she messed up her hands really bad. Like she had a bunch of like rope twine and like thistles stuck in her fingers and hands.
Ow.
Yeah. She was complaining about it and nobody listened, of course, because people are always trying to save money and make a movie fast. And yeah, but apparently that really happened. The director said it too. He just thought that she was complaining, but no, she was bleeding.
Oh, that's wow. Yeah, that, ouch. That sucks.
Yeah, that's on the commentary. He says that too. Like, yeah, I guess she ended up doing it though, but yeah, but that was the attraction was, that's why I think they shot in that store. I think from the commentary, if I recall, was because mainly it had that feature that they thought was, they became enamored with it.
I mean, it makes sense though, because like the scene, the way they use it where she's going up, like she's pulling herself up and the fisherman is like slashing at her. So it created a nice tense moment. But so she goes up and to the upstairs. And, of course, he just kind of goes up the stairs and chases her. And he corners her in the back room. She opens the window to the alleyway and jumps out into the debris out back. Which is kind of funny because in Scream, you know, that's how she meets her death, is by jumping, or while being thrown off a balcony. But the killer corners her and off she goes. So she ends up landing in the debris, gets up, and starts running down the alley. And, so we cut to Julie looking for her at the pageant, but it's completely empty. We cut back to Helen running through the alleyway. We see fireworks going off. The parade is just up ahead. There's these stacks of tires in the alleyway. And then Fish Sticks jumps out of nowhere, cuts her off right as the marching band cues up. They struggle. He overpowers her and kills her amidst the stacks of tires. So,
and
bye
she
bye.
Was so fucking close.
I know.
If she bye just bye, Buffy. Wouldn't have stopped.
Yep. So now, yeah, because that's the thing. She stops and like watches the band for a second. Like, oh, safety. It's like if you had just kept running. But then we cut to Julie. She can't find Barry or Helen, so she goes to find Ray. And she finds Ray at his boat. You know, she explains to him her theory about Susie's dad being the killer. Well, her dad Ben being the killer. Ray acts all creepy. We get that red herring moment again, and asks her to come inside. He's like, "Oh, come inside the boat." He takes her hand, and then she sees the name of the boat is Billy Blue. She freaks out. Yeah, exactly. She freaks out and is like, "You know, you were the one. You went and talked to Missy." And he's like, "Wait, I can explain." And she goes running off. Ray gives chase, and then suddenly a random fisherman just clotheslines Ray. Which cracks me up every fucking time. And then Julie tells him that she needs to call the cops, and he tells her to hurry up and get on the boat. So Julie runs and gets on the strange man's boat. Yeah, go on, get it. And then the fisherman follows her, undocks the boat, and climbs on. So Julie finds a room on the boat that's filled with photos of her and her friends, like photos and newspaper clippings. She tries to leave, but it's too late. The fisherman is there. And he's like, right, you know, blocking her way. And he goes, "You in some kind of trouble, child?" And she goes, yeah, I'm in a lot of trouble." And the fisherman walks over to a wall of like more newspaper clippings and photos of Susie Willis. And he spins the little charm from the beginning of the movie and hangs it on a photo. And then he says, "You know, that's a shame, it being 4th of July and all. Kids like you should be out there having fun, drinking, partying, running people over, getting away with murder, things like that." Which, again, I know that was meant to be, like, ominous, but I was giggling when he said, "running people over."
Yeah.
So Julie tries to run away. She sees that they're already out on the water, and she's trapped. And rather than jumping overboard and trying to swim to safety, because it's not like they could have been that far out, she decides to run around the boat, trying to escape the fishermen. Ben comes out with the hook, you know, or Fish Sticks comes out with the hook. She grabs a flare gun. He hits the accelerator on the boat. She's thrown back, and the flare gun goes overboard. So we see back on the dock, Ray wakes up, sees the boat's gone, hops in a little motorboat, and gives chase. So now, Julie...
what's up? Just because you said hops in a little motorboat and gives chase. Motorboat and brrrr.
Oh, man. So, well, that's what he was hoping to do with Julie again, because he keeps trying to get in her pants.
Exactly, but she doesn't want to know him.
Exactly.
In the biblical way again.
Yeah, she got sand in places last time. She wasn't too happy with it.
I have a question really quick.
Sure.
So, when she runs into the room in the boat, when she's like, "All right, random fisherman, you're going to save my life," there's all these pictures of them, but the one picture is clearly of Helen from earlier that day. So did he go to like the 1 hour photo and have Robin Williams develop it?
He had the Polaroid camera.
Yeah, that's true. He did have Polaroid.
Was that I didn't think it was a Polaroid though that he took. I thought they were like Kodak prints.
I mean, they probably were, but like he did have a Polaroid camera early in the film. So I mean, we kind of just write it off as that's what it was.
Movie magic.
He exactly. Also has a film lab on the boat where he can, you know, it's got that red light and he can just soak the photos. Or...
Ah,
that's
it's hidden behind the ice.
Yeah.
That's the other side of the fish storage. But yeah, so she hides below deck and Ray gets to the boat and climbs on and Ray and Ben start to fight. Julie hears it and pops up out of a little gopher hole on the deck. I was cracking up because she looked like a fucking gopher. She just
whack-a-mole.
Pops up. Right. And then she screams and Ray looks over and gets clocked with the hook and falls overboard. So now Julie goes back down below deck in the gopher hole, right as Ben comes for her. And we cut to see Ray holding onto the fishing net that's trailing behind the boat. So he's not gone yet. And then below deck, Ben tries to break into the room that she's hiding in. So she tries to go back out the little gopher hole, but he's barricaded it with, like, a bunch of chains and hooks in a basket on top of the thing so she can't get out. And then she goes into the fish storage right as Ben breaks into the door. So she starts piling all the ice up against the door trying to barricade it, and this is where she finds the bodies of Helen and Barry buried in the ice, and she starts screaming bloody murder. Ray gets back on the boat and starts climbing around like a little monkey, which cracked me up. It's like... You know she's below deck. Why are you climbing up in the mast? Like, I don't get it.
He wants to be able to see everything.
So Ben goes topside, and he opens up the fish storage. And I'm sorry, this part I laugh at every fucking time. As soon as he opens the door, Julie sees him and screams and does the pee-pee dance. Like, she just dances in place, like, flailing her arms. Oh, my God. It makes me wonder... did she know the door was going to open above her? Like the actual, like did Jennifer Love Hewitt know that? Because it seems like a genuine scare.
And she can dance. And she can dance. Julie is peeing her pants.
So that we see Ray up on the in the mast. He like unhooks one of the cargo lines and sends the cargo hook flying down at Ben, which clocks him in the face, knocking him on his ass. Ray swings down like Sloth from the Goonies. He's like, hey, you guys! And then Ben wakes up, Julie screams, Ben clocks Ray again, and corners Julie. And she's like, she says, please, it was an accident. And he goes, I know all about accidents. When you leave a man for dead, make sure he's really dead. And he goes to swing the hook, and he gets his arms caught in the his arm caught up in the ropes. And Ray pulls this lever, and it sends Ben flying up to the mast. And he gets his hand like slammed into the pulley. And it's a pretty gruesome shot where he just like loses his hand at the wrist. So then he falls down. The rope hooks his leg, and he swings like a screaming trapeze artist out over the water, and then falls into the sea. So, bye bye Ben. But so yeah, so he hits the water. We see Julie and Ray hug and sail back to the dock. We cut to the police at the docks. They're investigating the boat. Julie and Ray are discussing how they never actually killed anybody and they can have their lives back. And then we get that whole, you know, Ray loves her. He's like, I love you, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, I understand your pain, blah, blah, blah. You know, stupid.
So they didn't actually kill anybody, but they thought they did and then left him for dead by dumping his body in the ocean.
But it's okay because he was trying to kill them.
Right. But because he wasn't dead, that means they can get their lives back. Julie can start showering again. And washing her hair with Pantene.
And Ray can somehow go off to New York City and not be a fisherman, even though he needed to be a fisherman because he couldn't make it in New York City. But okay.
Right. And then it also begs to question when the cops go, do you know why this man was trying to kill you?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. They're like, nope, no, sorry. Nope. No clue.
And again, much like when Max met them on the road that fateful night when they didn't kill someone, it was not convincing at all.
No. So that I like it because they pull up the cargo net and we see Ben's severed hand holding the hook caught up in the net. And they're like, don't worry, the body will turn up eventually. They usually do. And then we cut to Julie at school. She's all happy and bubbly and talking to Ray on the phone. And she's
clean.
Yes, she's very clean. And she's going to take another shower, so she's going to be extra clean. And then she's talking about how he can ravage her when she comes to New York City. And then her roommate tells her that she's got some mail, and she leaves it in the locker room. Julie gets off the phone and goes to check the mail, and we see it looks like the envelope from the beginning. It just is addressed to Julie James. She opens it up, but it's an invitation for a pool party. Nothing scary. She goes back into the shower room, and it's super steamy. And then we hear, on the mirror, it's written, I still know. Then we hear the little medallion chime. And then suddenly Fish Sticks jumps through the mirror. We get the jump scare, cut to black, credits roll.
So here's my question about that final scene. Mm-hmm. She's not on a cell phone. That's like a legit cordless phone.
Right.
Now, I had lots of friends in college who lived in the dorms. I don't care how close to the bathroom you were. Your phone, your landline phone, did not reach into there.
Oh, no. No.
So was she just pretending to have, like, maybe not really, I'm going to push you away phone sex?
Maybe. Oh, man.
The end.
Yeah. Overall, I mean, it's a fun fucking movie. Like, it's silly. It's got its flaws. But it's just a fun movie, you know. It's and honestly, I forgot how much I enjoyed this film because I haven't out of the 90s and early 2000s slashers, this one has probably been like the longest for me since I've seen it. It's probably been about a good 15 years since I've watched it. I've recently rewatched the entire Scream franchise. I've rewatched Urban Legend 1 and 2, not part 3, but the first two. And then I love Cry Wolf. That one I go back and watch all the time. But it's been a long time, so it was nice to revisit this one. I really enjoyed it. I'm glad that the listeners voted it in. But anyone have anything they want to bring up here at the end?
Yeah, I love this movie. So I basically, I don't know if Mike told you, Maurice and Susie, I basically like threatened him with death if I couldn't be on this episode, because I was like, oh, if you ever do that movie, I'll be on it. I think I did ask to be on Blood Rage too, but I missed that train. So
yeah, that was one I remembered I wanted to try to get you on, but we had such a limited window to get it in. Oh,
no, I listen, it this has been wonderful, and I think if I was on the Blood Rage one, Maurice probably really would have sent me a note or a body in my trunk or something. So
well, especially because that one we all did, we did that in person since it was pre-corona.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And we had to watch as Maurice got more and more liquored up as the episode went on.
Oh, yeah. That's right, we did record that at his house because he needed to have booze in order to talk about it.
Yeah.
I think it's just that your butt hurt that you missed the opening night of Avengers.
Oh, that wasn't for Blood Rage. That was because
that was Mama.
Yeah. That was because of Burial Ground.
Oh.
But yeah, no, he just hated Blood Rage. I remember when we saw this at Thursday Night Terrors, or Blood Rage at Thursday Night Terrors, like, because it was both of our first time ever seeing it. And like, I'm enjoying it. I'm watching it with a smile on my face, and I keep looking over, and Maurice is just staring daggers at me. Like, you dragged me to this shit, you asshole.
That's to be celebrated. But
that might become a Thanksgiving tradition for me.
Same. Oh,
yeah, it is for me. I just one last thing. I really like this movie, and I'm sorry if it sounds like I'm pontificating on it, or I'm gonna write like a thesis on it and retroactively analyze a movie that is just, I think it's really a solid, well-built machine with those like classic slasher weirdness, but then also like kind of enough built into it, like that seriousness in the engine. And then I was to circle back, like this ending, like rewatching it, like it's so weird how they repeat the same mistake. Like,
yeah,
they at the very end, they don't, they're really not absolved of anything. And I know in the sequel, it kind of addresses the jump scare at the end as a something or a dream.
Yeah. I was gonna say, wasn't it a dream sequence or a hallucination?
Yeah. That's what they're saying. But I was like, what? And like, this killed these people for like a year. And especially the, Julie, like why, what in God's name? And it was just, I think that relief, and I'm like, I don't know what that says, but I think that's kind of cool that that's inserted into the movie in a way that they weren't like, oh no, this is what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Which the book is much more ambiguous about too. So
I'm definitely gonna have to check out the book, because I it has piqued my curiosity.
I will tell you this, the book, they hit a little boy.
Oh.
Oh.
Yeah, they hit a kid. It's not a man.
So that's much different.
Oh, it's much heavier than this. This is like kind of the brisk, fun version of that. So.
Oh wow.
Mhm.
That's brisk, baby.
Yeah.
Maurice coming in with the zingers.
Speaking of the 90s.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
A couple of bits of trivia that we didn't, because we covered a lot of the trivia that I had written here, but one of the things I found interesting was that the ice in the storage, the fish storage area, was actually made of gelatin, so Jennifer Love Hewitt, you know, could move around comfortably in it. I was like, that's kind of cool, because when I was watching it, I'm like, it looked convincing, like, it was really well made, so I'm like, hey, that's cool. And then Melissa Joan Hart was apparently up for one of the leads, but turned it down because she said it seemed like another Scream ripoff. So, like, that's kind of funny.
Oh, Sabrina the Teenage Witch.
Yeah, which is funny, because didn't she show up in Scream 2 as one of the sisters in the sorority? Or am I thinking of another movie? Because I feel
you're
like...
You're thinking of Can't Hardly Wait.
I was just going to say that, yes.
I don't think she was in Scream.
No, I don't think she was in Scream. She was the girl in Can't Hardly Wait who was going around going, sign my yearbook. Sign my yearbook.
Yes.
Now I remember that. I swear I could have sworn she was in some slasher movie. Like just as a bit part. Oh, that's gonna bug me now.
I'm gonna consult the bones really quick.
I mean, maybe I'm just really off the, you know, off on this one, but I'm looking at IMDb here, and I'm like, yeah, I apparently am completely wrong on this.
So she really wasn't.
I'm not seeing. Let's see, we're going back to 99. When did Scream 2 come out? 99 or 2000? No, 2000 was.
I think it was
98.
98. Oh yeah, you know you're right. It is. It was like Christmas of 97, because I Know What You Did Last Summer, I think, came out in the fall of 97, just before Scream 2.
Yeah.
Scream 2, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not seeing it here. So
yeah.
Apparently,
no, it's Can't
I am,
Hardly Wait.
Yeah, I'm apparently I'm assuming that was a slasher film somehow. weird how that happens. But yeah, I don't know. I just had it in my head that she was one of them. But you know what? I think it might be that I'm getting fucked up in my head. Is that weren't some of the sisters in Scream 2 like other actresses? Like, well, the Noxzema girl was in there, who was in Urban Legend later.
The one was Melissa Gayhart, I think, right?
Rebecca Gayhart.
Rebecca Gayhart.
The Noxzema girl. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. And then the other one was, isn't it? Who's the lady that was married to Ellen DeGeneres? Portia de Rossi. Okay. DeRossi didn't sound like the right last name in my head, but I was pretty sure it was her there in that too.
Rebecca Gayhart, Portia de Rossi were sorority sister Lois and sorority sister Murphy.
Okay, maybe that's what I'm thinking of. I don't know. I just had it in my head that she was in one of those, but yeah, that's memory plays tricks on you when you get old.
I mean, Portia is also blonde.
Right. But anywho, so yeah, I think we're running a bit long, so we should probably start wrapping this up. For our social media, if anyone's not following us, check us out on Instagram and Facebook. We're the Boogeyman's Closet, and Maurice handles our Twitter, which is
@ Boogeyman's.
Thank you, sir. And for any new listeners, we are running giveaways right through the end of the year, trying to make 2020 a little bit better. We currently have one for July that'll be done actually pretty soon. We only got one more episode in July after this, so it'll be up when that episode comes out, like the winner of that prize pack. So if you're not, you know, not participating yet, there's still time to get in on that. And then, yeah, we'll have another one for August and September and right on through. So if you're not following us, definitely check it out. Chance to get some free swag. And yeah, Eric, I'm glad you were able to join us for this. I would love to have you on again. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah,
absolutely. This was a blast. I really like this. Yeah. And if you guys do the sequel, I'll be there. And if you do like a kind of bottom of the barrel series and you do the third one, I'll be there.
Awesome. And, you know, honestly, I feel like we should do a couple just discussion specials and talk about some of these movies, because I was having a lot of fun when we were all just discussing the 90s era slashers. So
yeah,
maybe we'll have to discuss that a little. But all right. Yeah, I think we're going to wrap this up if no one else has anything to add.
Nope.
All right. Well, this is Mike saying goodbye.
See ya.
Bye.
Peace.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed what you heard, follow us on Instagram @ The Boogeyman's Closet, where you can stay up to date with everything we have planned.